Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good day, everybody. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion. Today's the 22nd of June. We will continue listening to Master Tenzin Chosen's program with the book Mind Trainings Like the Rays of Sun by Lam Kapow. And please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello once more and welcome to the program, whether you've joined us before or are a newcomer. In Tibetan Buddhism, meditation is defined as familiarizing the mind, and this applies to both concentration meditations as well as insight meditations. By constantly focusing and refocusing on an object like the breath, we familiarize the mind with placement or concentration. While focusing again and again on looking deeply into the nature of things, we familiarize the mind with the conditions for insight, particularly the insight leading to realization of the nature of reality. That, of course, leads directly to enlightenment. However, in the meantime, we have to practice familiarizing the mind with positive and beneficial ways of approaching things and weakening the negative and unhelpful. Why? Because, as the Buddha taught, if our mind is very focused on negativity or non-virtue, it makes it much harder to develop the qualities of concentration and insight that we need to free ourselves from suffering forever. Only with a strong ethical foundation can we develop concentration and wisdom. Yet, if we look deeply into our mind, we might well see a host of negative influences that are just waiting to cause trouble on the spiritual path. So, we have to make efforts to seriously weaken and overcome those influences if we really want to progress. And this is what in Tibetan Buddhism they call the mind training teachings. These teachings help us to turn the mind away from influences, habits, imprints, and tendencies, whatever you want to call them, that tend to both result in some sort of suffering or the other, and turn our head away from the spiritual direction we're trying to go in. Those of you who were with us last week might remember we ended the program with a quote from His Holiness the Dalai Lama, part of which stated, "In order for our happiness to come about, it must have some prior cause. Happiness depends primarily on the state of mind. If a person's mind is happy, then whatever his or her external circumstances may be, this person continues to be happy. If someone is basically a happy person, polite, considerate of others, a cultivated and good person, then whether or not they actually believe in religion or Dharma doesn't make any difference. If we are refined and considerate of others, we build up positive force or merit in any case. If, on top of that, we were to study and practice, training in the various methods of Dharma, there would be an even stronger benefit, not only in this life, but also future lives as well." Now, of course, some people are born with a naturally sunny disposition, while others go about as though under clouds so dark, their world seems to be always in some kind of miserable night. But neither of these states define the person, and both can change. Not that we particularly want to change a happy outlook for a miserable one, but most of us have some causes for unhappiness rooted in our minds, and it's those that the teachings help us to transform. For some, the transformation may come from an epiphany of some sort. For others, it needs a long, slow process of mind training, and that's where we come in. We're looking at a text that tells us how to train so that over time we can transform our negative attitudes. Titled Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, it's by the Tibetan master Nam Kha Pel and is a commentary on the 7 points of mind training teachings as originally formulated by one Geshe Chikawa. We're going through the first of the 7 points, the preliminary practices. The other 6 points are the methods of training in the two bodhicittas, relative and ultimate, transforming adverse circumstances into the path, condensation of the practice into one lifetime, the measure of having trained the attitudes, the close bonding practices for mind training, and the points to train in. But we'll come to those in due course. Last week, we completed going through the background to the first of the preliminary meditations. That was on precious human rebirth. We looked at why this human rebirth is regarded as precious, which included its potential for enlightenment, its rarity, and its difficulty to obtain. The point of considering the precious human rebirth is to make us appreciate the very special opportunity it gives us to practice the Dharma and attain, if not full enlightenment, then high realizations, but at least high rebirth, so that we can continue on our spiritual journey. The next preliminary meditation is on impermanence and death, to emphasize that we will inevitably die, but we have no idea when our death will occur. Realizing this, we develop a sense of urgency to practice and make progress so that we don't waste this precious opportunity. But before we go into this, let's set our motivation as we usually do. We all want happiness and don't want suffering of any sort. This is obvious even in the smallest of creatures. We have the means in the Buddha's teachings to attain a long-term happiness and banish discontent and misery forever. However, understanding that we all want the same thing and to avoid the same thing, wouldn't it be better to work to relieve the misery of all beings rather than just one's own misery? For instance, if a car with four people crashes and overturns, and you're at hand to rescue the people, would you only try to save one? Or would you do your best to save all four? Similarly, if we had the chance to save everyone on Earth from a planetary disaster, would we consider only ourselves and those dear to us? Or would we at least make the attempt to save everyone? Now, I, of course, can't answer for you. You have to do that for yourself. But if we can help many, why not do it? So setting our motivation today, let's focus on making this program the cause of our enlightenment so we can help countless others in whatever way they need, but especially so they too can become enlightened and so free from all their suffering. But if you really feel you're not able to do that yet, please motivate at least for your own liberation. Thank you. Now, having ended last week's program with an introduction by His Holiness to the subject of death and impermanence, I wonder if you thought about what he said and let it make some impression on your mind. Did it make enough of an impression for you to contemplate it over the last week? Remember, he pointed out how important it was to make the best use of our human rebirth. He said we must think about the disadvantages of ignoring life's underlying impermanence and the advantages of meditating on it. He concluded, "So this is a very worthwhile pursuit as regards making the best use of the working basis that we have. We need to realize that this precious human body will not last forever, that however perfect our circumstances may be, this life is something that will pass. This is because everyone is subject to impermanence and death. The main point is not to waste our time. Therefore, it's extremely important to think about impermanence and how all situations pass." He further says, "It's important because whether we believe in it or not, there are future rebirths. We may fall into one of the worst states or one of the better ones. So it's important to be aware of our negative potentials that may lead to a worse rebirth, and in turn, take in our actions and things we do now, since they will affect our future. If we aren't really mindful of death all the time, even if we practice the Dharma, we won't involve ourselves fully in the Dharma or fully take it seriously. If we are truly aware of death and impermanence, and of how what occurs in the future depends on what we do now, it is unnecessary to have police keeping check on us. Our own awareness of cause and effect will act as guards and keep us from acting inappropriately. Whoever we are, looking at things in the light of the fact that we are all going to die will make us realize there's no point in fooling others or acting in an uncaring manner. At least we'll see that it's absurd to fool ourselves by acting self-destructively, since in the future we will have to face the consequences of what we've done. So it's extremely important to be aware of death and impermanence all the time. Namkar Pal's text says, we should think about how being unmindful of death is the main cause of the whole heap of mistakes performed in this and future lives, and how familiarity with death and impermanence is advantageous, the sole means for achieving everything in this and future lives. The fear of being separated from your body, possessions, and relatives in this life to which you are attached, caused by thinking about death, is not the fear intended here, for that is the fear of one who has no understanding of the path. What is this about? Everything that is born from a union of parents, due to the forces of action and disturbing emotions, is bound to die, and although you may fear it, it cannot be avoided. Moreover, until we have accomplished the purpose of our future lives, we will continue to fear death. If you think about that and realize it, at the time of death you will have no fear. And that's Namkar Pal. This reminds me of something Ram Dass, the great spiritual teacher, said about the fear of death when talking about suffering on the website www.ramdass.org. He advises to develop what we call a contextual appreciation of suffering and says, suffering is part of the fabric of a human incarnation, as is death. And not feeling that death is the enemy, but that death is part of a process. Just like autumn and winter aren't enemies of spring and summer, they are just continuing parts of the process. Now, part of that is aided a lot by understandings and deepening faith in the fact that there's a soul or there's a spiritual context in which physical existence dwells. And as you develop that spiritual context and appreciate that suffering from within that context is the stuff of growth, then under those conditions, you're much more capable of handling the physical conditions, even though your heart is breaking. And it is breaking, and it will break, and you will feel depressions, and you will feel like crying, and you have to be honoring that psychological process that is going on. At the same moment, you keep cultivating the other part of you, and instead of judging God, why have you done this? Says, let me understand. Give me the wisdom to understand and to grow strong through this, and to appreciate the way in which all things are changing constantly, and all of life is an interconnected circle from birth to death. His Holiness the Dalai Lama explains in part how we can develop that spiritual context that Ram Dass demands. He talks about all the things that appear important to us when we take no notice of death, that seem to make this life worthwhile. Mainly, those are good companions, good health, and good resources, like house, car, fridge, and so on. He says, how do we train to gain that awareness of death and impermanence? We do this first by being aware of the fact that none of our possessions, our friends, relatives, and so forth, will be of help at the time of death. Then we need to reflect on all the circumstances that will occur at the time of death, that all the objects we have acquired, perhaps through deceit or cheating or going to a lot of trouble to do so, are not going to be helpful at all when we die. But we're going to have to endure the consequences of any deceptive means that we may have used. It is certain that we're all going to die because we are under the influence of disturbing attitudes and the various impulses of karma on our mental continuum. Even kings must die, and some are even executed. If we spend our time totally ignoring this fact, fooling ourselves, lying, doing all sorts of deceitful things, we are in for a surprise at the time of death, a great deal of regret and remorse. If we are mindful and aware of the fact that we will die, we would act in a better way while we are alive and wouldn't have to die with regret and remorse. Although it's impossible to prevent ourselves from dying, we can prepare so that at the time of death we don't have to die in a state of terror. It's only a matter of time until death comes, so it's worthwhile for us to prepare for it now. Do you know one of the most famous of Dylan Thomas' poems, the one called Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night? It was written for his father, who'd been a militant and active man during his life, but who weakened with age and later became blind. Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at the close of day, rage, rage against the dying of the light. The wise men at the end know dark is right. Because their words had forked no lightning, they do not go gentle into that good night. Good men, the last wave by, crying how bright their frail deeds might have danced in a green bay, rage, rage against the dying of the light. Wild men who caught and sang the sun in flight and learned too late they grieved it on its way, do not go gentle into that good night. Grave men near death who see with blinding sight, blind eyes could blaze like meteors and be gay, rage, rage against the dying of the light. And you, my father, there on the sad height, curse, bless me now with your fierce tears, I pray. Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Now, should we rage against the inevitable, the dying of the light? Of course, we may well do, if we look back on our lives and see our actions that brought regret and remorse. Perhaps, as wise men, we may regret that our words had forked no lightning, or as good men, how bright our frail deeds might have danced in a green bay. Perhaps we might regret not making something more worthwhile of our lives, as wild men who sang the sun in flight. But worse, we will regret if we saw how we ourselves and others had suffered through actions done with carelessness or even malicious intent. But what is the use of raging when death is upon us and nothing is now to be done? Would it not be better to bring death to the forefront of our minds right now and live with the knowledge that, as Ram Dass says, things are changing constantly and all of life is an interconnected circle from birth to death? When I was still working, I remember mentioning something about imagining lying on your deathbed and looking back on your life to a colleague. Would it be filled with regret, or would you be at peace with the way it had gone? The co-worker got all pursed-lipped and buried her head back in her computer, saying something like, "Why do you want to talk like that? It's so morbid." Such is our fear in the West of even approaching the idea of death. Still, Ram Dass thinks we are becoming more open to death. He writes, "For many decades, death was kept behind closed doors. But now, we're allowing it to come out into the open. Having grown up in this culture, the first few months I spent in India in the 1960s were quite an experience. There, when someone dies, the body is placed on a pallet, wrapped in a sheet, and carried through the streets to the burning grounds while a mantra is chanted. Death is out in the open for everyone to see. The body is right there. It isn't in a box. It isn't hidden. And because India is a culture of extended families, most people are dying at home. So most people, as they grow up, have been in the presence of someone dying. They haven't walked away from it and hidden from it as we have in the West." But in his book, What Makes You Not a Buddhist, Dzongsa Khenza Rinpoche thinks that we are open about death because we have basically turned it into an entertainment. In this information age, we are surrounded by images of decay and death. Beheadings, bullfights, bloody murder, he writes. Far from reminding us of our own fate, these images are used for entertainment and profit. Death has become a consumer product. Most of us do not contemplate the nature of death on a deep level. We don't acknowledge that our bodies and environment are made up of unstable elements that can fall apart with even the slightest provocation. Of course, we know that one day we will die. But most of us, unless we have been diagnosed with a terminal illness, think that we're in the clear for the time being. On the rare occasions that we think about death, we wonder, how much will I inherit? Or where will they scatter my ashes? In that sense, we are unsophisticated. As Rinpoche says, we know we will die, but it's only a kind of intellectual knowledge that doesn't really affect us much because we think it will happen in the future. Someday, but not now, we think. And we think like that every day. Well, how many times today have you thought, I could die today, I could die in the next few minutes, in the next minute? We don't, do we? We continuously put death into the future, and that effectively says we will never die. Even when we're lying in the hospice and the smell of dying hangs turgid in the air, we think, not just yet, I still have some time. I've often told the story of the neighbor to the Buddhist temple I lived in Auckland some years back. She was a frail old lady in her 70s or 80s whose husband had died many years before. The last time I visited her, the conversation revolved around her wonderful husband and a candelabra that she'd loaned a friend but which had not been returned. This old neighbor could no longer stand on her own 2 feet. When she came to the door to see me out, she had to lean against the wall, and death was coming very close. In fact, not too long after, she moved into a nursing home because she couldn't cope by herself anymore. And yet, instead of admitting to what she was facing, her mind lingered on her long-gone husband and a candelabra she had no hope of ever using again. She was determined to travel to Dargaville to fetch the useless thing. Thus it is that even when light reflections from death's scythe are blinding us, we still pretend the Grim Reaper is not standing right before us and has actually been doing so all the time. In the text on the graduated path to enlightenment, the contemplation on death is covered by 9 points, each 3 leading to a different conclusion. The 9 points are death is inevitable, it's coming closer instant by instant, and up until this time, I've done little to prepare for the time of death. These 3 points lead to the conclusion that I'd better prepare for death. The next 3 points are that I don't know when death will come, there are many agents of death in the environment, and this body is weak in being able to counter these agents. These 3 points lead to the conclusion that I'd better start preparing for death right now. Then the last 3 points consider what is useful at the time of death. We've already seen that those things that make life happy, namely good companions, resources, and health, do not help at death time. So we have to determine what will help at death and work to develop that. Thus, the conclusion is that I should prepare for death carefully and properly. So the 3 conclusions come to the understanding that I must prepare for death, I must start right now, and I must prepare properly. The Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun text covers all these points under the subheadings of the 3 most important, namely that death is inevitable, its time of arrival is uncertain, and only one's practice of the Dharma will be of use at the time of death. In considering the first point, the text first quotes a verse from another text called Special Verses Collected by Topic that states that if all the Buddhas and Arhats inevitably have to give up their bodies, ordinary beings cannot hope to avoid doing so too. And another verse from the same text is quoted to show that no matter where you go or what you do, death always goes with you. Wherever you live, you're not immune to death, it states, neither on earth in any direction, nor in space, nor within the ocean, nor if you were to hide amidst the mountains. And you can't even avoid death by taking rebirth. The same text says, the wise have understood that those of the past and those who are yet to come have given up this body and are subject to destruction. Therefore, abide in the doctrine and practice with determination. In his commentary, His Holiness the Dalai Lama says this, with respect to the fact that death is certain, it's said that if even the innumerable Buddhas and Arhats have to die, what can be said about ordinary people such as us? No matter who we are, once we're born, it is 100% sure that we will die. There's nobody who doesn't have to die, so there's no question of our avoiding it. And if we look at the various Buddhas who, before becoming enlightened, had achieved the state of an illusory body and subsequently attained enlightenment in that state without actually passing away, there are very few. Most have demonstrated passing away into parinirvana. If we take examples in history, kings and emperors and so forth, we cannot find anyone who actually achieved immortality. There is no place to go to escape death, and although we may have a very strong body, there is no body strong enough to resist death. Just like being in a place surrounded by mountains on all sides, trapped with no way to escape, likewise, when it comes to death, there is no way we can run to escape it. This last is an explanation of a quote in Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun from the Sutra of Advice for a King, which runs, suppose four great mountains in the four directions, solid, stable, essential, uncrumbled, uncracked, unblemished, very hard, extremely dense, and touching the sky, were to be overturned. The grass, forests, tree trunks, branches, all the leaves, all the living beings and creatures would be crushed to the smallest particles. This would not easily be avoided by escaping quickly or with strength, nor by wealth, substances, mantras, or medicine. O great king, likewise, the four great fears cannot easily be avoided by escaping quickly or with strength, nor by substances, mantras, or medicine. What are these four? Old age, sickness, death, and decline. O great king, old age comes with the destruction of youth, sickness with the destruction of health, decline with the destruction of all your fortune, and death comes with the destruction of life. They cannot easily be avoided by escaping quickly, or with strength, nor with wealth, substances, mantras, or medicine. All these mentions of the transience of even kings reminds me of the poem Ozymandias by Percy Bysshe Shelley, which I must admit to you having used in previous programs when talking about impermanence and death. But it's so fitting, I'm going to quote it again. I met a traveller from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read which yet survive, stamped on those lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal these words appeared, my name is Ozymandias, king of kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing besides remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. No matter how high and mighty we may become, our inevitable destination is death and decay. Steve Jobs was the helmsman of the most profitable company in the world, but where's he now? What is he now, besides some rotting bones and fading memories? His Holiness points out that we cannot escape death because we carry the causes for death within ourselves wherever we go. And no surgeon, no matter how skillful, can operate and relieve us of those causes. Imagining things that might happen from which there would be no escape, like a nuclear war, does us no good, he says. In any case, death is inescapable. We cannot put the blame on external things that might cause our death, always living in fear of things such as nuclear war. The causes of death are accumulated within our mental continuum. The disturbing attitudes, karma, and so forth are the internal causes that will bring about our death, together with external contributing circumstances. The main point is, having been born in a body with disturbing attitudes and karma on our continuum, it is certain that we're going to die. This is because the moment the body is actualized, at the same time are actualized the causes for death. And with that, we must say farewell, for our time together today is up. Thank you for being with us, and please do tune in again next week. Kindly dedicate all the positive potential from the program to gaining enlightenment for the benefit of all beings everywhere. Have a wonderful week. Thank you, and goodbye.